John Porter.
Hello, Glenn Lowry. How are you doing after the election?
Doing well after the election. I survived the election. Welcome to the Glenn Show at BlockingHeads.tv. John, so we are here just to have a quick chat in the aftermath of this momentous election, having talked so much about politics. Indeed, our conversations about politics go all the way back to 2008.
Mm-hmm.
Having gained some notoriety here at the Blocking Heads site for our original and idiosyncratic opinions, could we say that?
I guess so.
So now you must have been very pleased with the election outcome, John.
I'm very pleased for a number of reasons, and especially in that it wasn't really close. It started to look like it would have been, depending on when you started watching TV, but it happened. There was this phase shift, and we had a new president. And I am really pleased that the person who you could argue would seem to have had more of a reason for wanting to be president and who was less duplicitous in his message was the one who won. I feel that there was a kind of justice in it. And so, yeah, I feel good. I really do feel good, and there's a part of me that also wonders whether Obama might be in a position to do some at least slightly more interesting things now that he doesn't have to worry about getting reelected. How do you feel?
Less duplicitous. So I had a conversation here at Blogging Heads with my son, also in the post-election environment, in which we spent some time arguing about who had run the more negative campaign and whether or not Romney was a liar and all this kind of stuff. And the position that I took, which I'll take with you too, is that the campaign is over and that I understood during the campaign the need to nurture certain characterological narratives, attributing this or that humane or inhumane quality to the preferred candidate and the inhumane to the dispreferred candidate. I understood the sort of logic of that during the election, but in the aftermath, I don't see any need to trumpet the non-duplicity of the president, who I think ran a conventional negative campaign against Mr. Romney, in which he put on a lot of ads that didn't talk about his record but talked about why the other guy was unacceptable, and he was very shrewd at marshaling support from the various pastiche of constituencies that in aggregate constitute the Democratic coalition, and ran a more effective and artful campaign than did his opponent, and may have at some level been a more appealing person than his opponent was able to fashion himself. But I see no reason to lionize Obama at this time or whatever. Of course, I also see no reason to criticize him, because after his victory and knowing that he'll be president for the next 4 years, I don't want to make myself boorish by pointing to anything negative about the president. So I'm kind of constrained by political correctness here to affirm his virtues. How do you react to that soliloquy, John?
Oh, I get it. I'm not, I don't think that Obama ran anything like this, this perfect Philosopher King's campaign. He has learned, well, I would say he has learned that it would behoove him to get down and dirty and negative where he has to. I'm not sure how he necessarily could have pulled this off without going negative to an extent. I mean, it would be kind of a thought experiment. He wasn't perfect, and I actually find I found his performance in the first debate not just a matter of being thrown by the fact that Mitt Romney was playing a centrist, but by a certain, this is the first time I've ever used this word in connection with Obama, but a certain inherently superior, aloof attitude towards the whole notion of debating and going mano a mano with this person, which I really found rather unadmirable. He shouldn't have been caught like that. But I think in terms of duplicitousness, and that's quite a word, but in terms of willful distortions of the truth in order to sway a certain less reflective part of the electorate into voting for him, I think that the general consensus is that Romney was ahead on that kind of thing. You know, the welfare, the claim that Obama was trying to reverse welfare reform, the whole take on Benghazi, and any number of other things.
Well,
Romney just
wait a minute.
Wanted to win.
I think Benghazi's a real issue, and I'm not saying that from some partisan Fox News whatever. I just think when I hear a Dianne Feinstein, chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee on a Sunday News show recently, venting and gesticulating and saying that we need to get to the bottom of some stuff, not in an arch way. She wasn't attacking Susan Rice. This is Senator Dianne Feinstein of California, who's the chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee. Mm-hmm. But she was saying there's questions, and she ran them down 1, 2, 3, ABC. All these people are not crazy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what did the attorney general tell about the investigation, David Petraeus, et cetera, et cetera? I grant you that these are questions that the partisan hacks will make a great deal of as they attempt to discredit the president and keep their ratings up on right-wing talk radio. But still, they're questions that I think serious people who are not in that camp want to know the answers to. So I would just say that.
It's a real – certainly it's a real issue that bears investigation.
The other thing I want – I'm sorry, son. I'm sorry, John. I didn't mean to cut you off.
Son. But I think that the idea that Mitt Romney was trying to accuse Barack Obama of being willfully misleading or egregiously asleep at the switch in the course of this debate was a really low blow, especially considering that, from what I recall, Di-Fi, as she used to be, I imagine still is called affectionately out in California, found herself that there really wasn't anything to be concerned about in this particular way. Of course, that's after the fact of those debates. But it was a really low move and something that he started, and I didn't see Obama doing as much of that sort of thing. The complexity of the debate acknowledged.
Okay. Well, I don't really think it's worth arguing about, even if we don't share exactly the same sensibility, since the fact of the matter is Obama was reelected going away, and we're looking at another 4 years. You know, what do you think will be different, if anything, in this coming term? Or what do you hope will be different?
Right now?
Yeah, I'm just saying, second term, Obama administration, first black president, Democrat, centrist Democrat, I guess you have to call him. Mm-hmm. Though the opponents want to call him a lefty. I mean, he's not a lefty. He's gotten reelected. I mean, he ran on raising taxes on the rich. He ran on Affordable Care Act, although not as vigorously as some would have hoped. You know, what do we think he's going to accomplish in the next 4 years? I mean, he's going to have to make some major appointments in cabinet positions now. I mean, what's the Obama doctrine as far as foreign policy is concerned? What about the immigration issue, where he seems to have laid down implicit promises to the Hispanic constituency that he's going to actually try to do something. You know, there are all these fiscal issues that are pressing, and now maybe he's got more leverage. You know, as George Bush said in 2004, I won the election, I got political capital, I'm going to spend it. Well, Obama won the election, he's got, after fashion, political capital. Would you hope him to spend it?
I think that what we're going to see in particular, and I'm really interested in seeing this because it's been a long time now that we haven't seen what we had been accustomed to see as functioning government. And I think that claims that the government is at a standstill now that is unprecedented in history are exaggerated. But nevertheless, it's been pretty frustrating, not just over the past 2 years with the 4 years with a particularly recalcitrant Republican Congress, but everything that we've seen even throughout the second Bush administration, and even in the second half of the Clinton administration. I think the Republicans have to be chastened at this point, not for any moral reason, but just in terms of what they've seen, the perils of their electability are if they continue with this rather strident, obstructionist, and often anti-empirical way of approaching what governing is. And I think that Obama also, especially as somebody who's reputed to read op-eds a lot about himself and is very concerned about his reputation, I think is going to be prepared to deal with what remains of that Republican obstructionism more. As such, I think that he is going to be a much tougher negotiator on this fiscal cliff, which is coming, and I think that he's going to be in a position to take advantage of the Republicans' mood to give him a little bit more leeway, at least. We're going to be seeing more of an approximation of the idea of politics being about genuine compromise. So anything that he wants to do, I imagine that we'll see things such as the, you know, rather uninspiring but progressive compromise, such as the Affordable Care Act. We'll see more of those things instead of roughly nothing which is what we've seen particularly over the past 2 years. I'd like to see what a real Obama administration might look like, or an approximation. So I'm moderately anticipating that sort of scene. Do you think there's a chance of it?
No. in a word, I think there's going to be gridlock. You and I have pretty different views about what's going to happen.
Why do you think so?
Because I think the Republican Party's in a deep hole, and I think it's going to be messy, them getting out of it. And I don't see enough coherence there in the Republican Party to sort of, I don't know, take the House of Representatives, whip people into line in such a way that any deal that might be negotiated. I'm not predicting we're going to go over the cliff now. I'm not saying they will pass no necessary legislation. They won't extend the debt limit as it needs to be extended to keep the finances of the government, and they won't avoid the automatic sequestration that would go into effect if they're not able, within a relatively few weeks, in fact, to begin to make some kind of progress on the budget impasses. I'm not saying nothing will get done. But I don't see a golden age of comprehensive immigration reform, broad-based restructuring of the tax code, major engagement with the long-term problems of the entitlement. I see a lot of trench warfare. I see filibusters and oppositions to the president's appointments for key positions. I see continued difficulty with him having an influence over the federal bench, as he might want to, because appointments will get held up in the Senate. I see a 2016 campaign that's going to start in 2013, in effect, on both sides of the aisle. I don't think, again, with respect and in light of the fact that the president has won, that the president is a sufficiently strong leader, has shown himself to be a sufficiently forceful commander of the apparatuses of his office and of the American state, that he's going to be able to create a new dispensation out of the chaos of the Republican Party and the serendipitous majoritarian character of the Democratic coalition. I assume I've got myself now in enough trouble with the viewership that I can stop. I wasn't impressed in turn number one, and I don't anticipate to be impressed in turn number two. Make a fool out of me. I'll be happy if the president proves to be much more effective at dealing with some of those things that I was just ticking off. I don't see it happening.
Let's revisit this in, let's try December of 2013, because I'd be very interested to see which one of us is right. And the truth is probably going to be somewhere in the middle. But I think that one thing that Barack Obama has shown with his inexperienced self is that he does learn. He learns and he does new things. He learned how to be a better campaigner back in 2007 and 2008. Remember back when Maureen Dowd was calling him O Bambi and everybody thought that was so cute, and everybody thought that because he has an angular smile and is skinny that he wouldn't be able to withstand the pressure? Well, he learned, and I think that he has learned how to be more forceful, at least in terms of his oratory when he's talking about putting over a policy in a forceful way. He wasn't good at that for the first 2 years. He's gotten a lot better at it. And I'm thinking that that same learning curve will mean that he will be a tougher negotiator after the shellacking that he took for his debt negotiations back in 11. I've never seen the man not learn. You know, here we always talk about how intelligent he is. Here's one way where he tends to apply it. I find it hard to imagine him spending the next 4 years being as feckless a leader as he often was during the first four. He's not that ordinary. And then, briefly, also, just with the Republicans, I don't know, it may be part of the reason I see them changing is because for so many years I was part of a think tank where most of the people were Republicans, and I listened to those people talk. I sat with my white wine at way too many of those afternoon forums where they talk about where we're going to go from here. And the fact is, when they start losing, when it really starts looking like they're going to go the way of the Whigs, there are many ears, and maybe it was just the kinds of Republicans I tended to know, but there are many ears who are open to moderating the message in order to stay in power, and that certainly must be what's happening at this point. So I'd be interested if what you're talking about happened, but I guess I have, I hate to say it, but hope.
Well, here's why I think the Republicans are in this deep hole. Not that they're not forces that are adaptive in the way that you just said. I mean, I heard Bill Kristol say,
for example,
say on in his magazine something to the effect of maybe you ought to raise taxes on the rich just a little bit.
In light of the fact that
the president won the election, you know, maybe we shouldn't be fighting that one. If we lost it, why would we just pick that one to fight again and then lose it again? I mean, you know, let's move on to something else. Mm-hmm. So there is that. On the other hand, what I see is the Tea Party not going away, digging in. Okay, I think that the demographics are just inexorably against the Republicans. Fewer whites, the age profile of the population not favoring them. Weak with the youthful constituencies because of their positions on social issues, weakness with women on the reproductive rights questions.
Mm-hmm.
70% of the Latino vote going to the other party.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's just death. Now, I don't know how you turn that around even with a concerted effort, let alone turn it around on a dime.
Mm-hmm.
I think that some of these people who want their country back are going to go to their grave wanting their country back.
Mm-hmm.
And what you're going to have to see is a kind of breakdown of the old coalition. I mean, it's a southern party. I mean, you know, just look at the map about how the red states play out. Nothing against the South. I mean, I would not want to demonize it in any way. But that is not the future. Gay rights. I mean, mm-hmm. they just have to be against it as a party, and that they're just spitting in the wind.
Mm-hmm.
They're fighting the turning tide of history about the changing structures of our normative assessments and such like
and
that.
And so you see that as meaning that these people who are losing are just going to dig in their heels and keep doing the same stuff and then gradually exterminate themselves, as opposed to these people who are losing, seeing that they're losing and changing who they let be the ones who call the shots and becoming a different kind of party.
Well, yeah, I don't know how to predict the future exactly, but I'm saying that there's going to have to be some major kind of realignment of whatever the conservative party is, if it's going to become a majoritarian party again, from the remnants of the Republican lineup. Now, maybe they have to get more libertarian. Maybe they have to like cede a lot of ground on the immigration issue, but then try to appeal to the social conservatism and the kind of economic aspirations of a kind of working class Latino population.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they somehow have to find political leaders who can appeal to urban constituencies more effectively than they do. I don't know. I mean, maybe they need to nominate a Marco Rubio or something like that who can galvanize something. But it's going to have to be something new is what I'm saying, because a just straight line continuation of what they're doing now is getting them successively less and less of the aggregate vote, you know.
Well, Glenn, I'll try some history here, and I'm
I'm holding my seat.
Confident here, even though I'm not a historian.
That's what I'm saying.
Tea Party, that's over.
You think the Tea Party's over?
Yeah, I mean, already at this point, I think looking at how those people did in the election, looking at how they've fared in terms of changing the conversation for a spell but not staying in it, that's really becoming the news of 2009 and 10. I mean, I'll even concede, even though I've argued against this simplistic analysis, in the history books, the Tea Party, I think at this point, is going to be seen as a little blup of a movement that distracted Republicans for a brief period of time based on a certain telegenic charisma of a few figures and perhaps a certain discomfort with a black man being president. But let me finish.
Okay.
And I think a lot of the reason is because they did not have a truly coherent agenda other than a very unfocused kind of rage, just like the Occupy movement. Movements like that, kind of like the Know-Nothings way back in the 1800s, movements like that are really just about a sentiment, they tend not to last. You need more of an agenda, more organization, more ideological coherence. So I'm not worried about the Tea Party at this point. That's part of why I'm saying that we might see a new kind of Republican Congress. You think that those people are going to keep their purchase on Republican thinking after all those people?
Here's what I think. I think Theda Scotch Pohl and Vanessa Williamson, I believe that's her name, book on the Tea Party. warrants your and a lot of people's attention. It's not the only book about the Tea Party. It's the best one that I'm aware of out there. Interviewing, going to their websites, cataloging, tracking, following all around the country, trying to find out what the Tea Party is about. Point one, they are well organized. Okay. These people are active. They've got roots. This is not Occupy Wall Street. There's a structure there. Okay. They are white. They are older. They are of intense ideological fervor around the social issues and around the, you know, minimal government intrusion and this kind of thing. And the very fact that they were able to get the nominations in some of these Senate fights away from more electable mainstream Republicans like Richard Lugar in Indiana or like that guy in Delaware in the 2010 cycle.
Mike Castle.
Right? Yeah, who would have been elected senator in Delaware. Instead, they nominated the lady who had to go say, I am not a witch.
And nobody's heard of her since.
Like Harry Reid's seat in 2010, which should have fallen to a Republican. This is the Senate majority leader who was really weak in his own constituency, notwithstanding all the natural advantages of the unions and whatnot that are built in Nevada. And yet they nominate this weak candidate against him who ends up losing Missouri with Claire McCaskill. So the very fact that these disasters for the Republican Party are happening on the ground tells me that the Tea Party is strong, not weak. But they can't go on, that is, the party can't go on nominating unelectable candidates, which is why I predict that they're in a hole. I'm saying that the thing has to go down, down, down until it finally implodes somehow and gets reorganized. And these various destructive forces of which the Tea Party from the Republicans' electoral prospects, at least in the short run, are a destructive force, have somehow to be accommodated. I don't think it's going to be easy, and I don't know what it's going to look like coming out of it, but I think it's going to be messy for a long time.
So we're arguing about timing, because I think we agree.
Yeah, maybe so.
And you're saying that it's going to take longer for the Republicans to adjust constructively to what these people have wrought than me. I'm thinking it's now. I'm thinking nobody would, you know, people like Sharon Angle and Christine O'Donnell, to me is very 2 years ago. You're thinking that that general influence isn't over yet, right?
Yeah, I don't think that influence is over because I think the issues are not, the Affordable Care Act is now going to be fought out in the states. There are 30 Republican governors in the 50 states, and there's going to be a big battle about the extent to which they accommodate the Europeanization of the American welfare state, which is the way in which this thing is going to be pitched. The coalition that elected the president does consist disproportionately of people who are, oh my God, how to say this without sounding like Bill O'Reilly, in a position of hoping the government will do something for them. And the pitch about, protecting our programs from these rapacious Paul Ryan-type Republicans who are roaming the country trying to cut everything back is a winning argument. But the opposition to that argument, which I think is deeply nested in the Tea Party, is not going away. So that argument is going to be out there. It's going to prevail for the time being, but it's going to foster a lot of opposition, which is going to make it difficult for the Republicans to get their act together or something. But I don't know what my prognostications are worth.
We agree. We agree.
We agree that they're not worth much.
Now, it's an interesting time.
Okay, John.
I'm glad that the president is the person who it is at this point. I don't think the country would have gone to hell in a handbasket if there was a President Romney. But I like this better for all sorts of reasons. And right now I'm not even thinking about the color of his skin.
Okay, two things I got to ask you about, John, that will they be different, and if so, how, in the next 4 years? One is the race discourse. Did black people dodge a bullet by Obama being reelected? Because after all, if he had been defeated, then the whole African-American community would have had a setback and it would have been, a bad thing for our reputation. So what about the race debate going forward? And the other thing is about the Middle East. Looks like Prime Minister Netanyahu bet on a losing horse. Looks like he tried to interfere in American politics by coming to the U.S. Congress and basically telling everybody that Obama was a bad guy and that, BB and Mitt were good friends. And it looks like now Obama is the president of the United States and the commander-in-chief of the U.S. military going forward for another 4 years, unfettered by the need to get reelected. Are we going to have a different kind of conversation about that?
Yes, we are. And I think that it's clear that, I mean, on that, for Obama to have been as unbridledly defensive of Israel as he was 2 days ago in saying that Israel has a right to defend itself. That
this
was clearly
in response to the Israelis' vigorous response to the rockets coming in from Hamas and Gaza that the president had been speaking. Yes.
Many people say disproportionately vigorous. But, yeah, for him to say something that clearly, and not just some sort of boilerplate, obviously meant something, especially at this particular time. Yeah, I'd be interested in seeing where that's going, given that Obama has been accused of being tepid on Israel, and therefore, of course, the rhetoric often goes that he's anti-Israel, and I don't think that's ever been true. I think he doesn't really care, but he does have certain gestures to make, and he made them. As far as saving Black America, yes, that's a sentiment that would have been there, but to me, the main aspect of it is that it saves a lot of people who care about Black America from doing an unintentional kind of harm, which is that if Obama hadn't won, then the whole debate now, well, it wouldn't be a debate. The assumption would be, and this would be among Black people as well as, you know, white fellow travelers, that he was defeated because he was Black, and nobody would be able to be budged from that analysis no matter how it was looked at. And I think that would have been a very unfortunate perspective to have in terms of having a truly progressive view on what race and racism and politics are about. So I think that negative thing, the fact that we cannot have that conversation, and that Barack Obama won not just once, but twice, and this time against an opponent that really gave him a run for his money, is really a something. We're going to have had a Black president for 8 years, and nothing the Tea Party said could get rid of him. I think that's a good thing. I don't think that it's the most important aspect of the Obama phenomenon in general, but, oh, I'm extremely relieved, because I don't think that what would have done him in was racism, but I couldn't have proven it any more than other people could have proven that it was, but essentially it would have been considered just decided, and I think it would have been a really unfortunate way to look at it. So I'm quite relieved. I know for you that that aspect of it doesn't matter as much, but I'm very relieved in that way.
Well, how do I think about this? We will have had two terms an African-American president. He was reelected so that the race mongers who want to go around saying race is the reason for everything that happens bad to an African-American will not have an Obama defeat to lean on as they make their weak argument. I guess I agree that that would be a weak argument. He would have been defeated if he had been defeated not because he was Black. That would have just played around at the margins. He would have been defeated because of many other reasons, having to do with the weak economy and perhaps a lackluster record from the first term and so forth. But he wasn't defeated. He won handily. But first Black president, two terms, you know, so what? I mean, really, no, I don't think it's that important. I think it's vastly overrated. All of this, the Obama effect, giving hope and inspiration to generations, whatever. I mean, I see the cosmetic case for that, but when I look deep down, I'm not persuaded. You know, there's a counter argument to the effect that actually he's a very conventional president, very much of a centrist or even right of center Democrat, and that the amalgamation of that centrality or right-of-center Democratic character with his Blackness in a way diminishes the brand of Black political aspiration. Because just because he's Black, I mean, just because his skin color is brown, I don't see any reason to take pride in that. I would take pride in somebody who actually did something that I thought was continuous with the historical imperative and kind of human decency aspirations of Black people's freedom struggle, changed American policy in a way that really reflected that. Now, people might say the Affordable Care Act represents that. I know that's what my friend Harold Pollack would say. He'd say it was a great historic extension of the thing that really transformed. Remains to be seen. I'm not persuaded of that about the Affordable Care Act, but I'm trying to keep an open mind about that. But in any case, you know, his blackness is not very important to me, and it makes me sometimes worry that he deploys the legacy and the history and the hope and aspiration and identity of African Americans on behalf of his own very ordinary political aspirations that are not at all dissonant with the sort of main thrust, as they would have to be if someone gets elected president, of American neocolonial, of American, you know, whatever. Okay, so anyway.
You know what you missed, though,
what do I miss?
On this, is, if I may? What an unusual and invaluable lesson just his being black, and almost in his being a rather mediocre president, too, is in that it is hard for the human mind to handle the in-between and the nuanced. It's not what we're designed for. We don't do it easily. Everything tends to be spontaneous for us about, so to speak, black and white. When Obama was elected, the grand idea was, among exactly the kind of people I'm talking about, America is not post-racial. You know, as if anybody said so, but there's this gut need for everybody to keep saying that over and over again. And the fact of the matter is, it's obvious America's not post-racial. Nobody ever needed to be told that. People just seem to need to keep saying it as a kind of an incantation, like many of them need to say Jesus loves you. But this is the point. If we all know that America's not post-racial, but at the same time, we know something as iconic and impossible to forget and impossible to ignore as that the president of the United States is black. Whatever black thing he's doing or not doing, he is black. His wife is blacker. He's got two kids. They're black, too. For people to have to see those two things all the time, the black president and the fact that there's racism, means that everybody gets a lesson in the fact that things are changing. It's very hard to convey that to any group of human beings, including you and to me. Our cognition doesn't work that way. But for him to be sitting there, whenever anybody wants to incant that racism still exists in America, and it does, whenever Obama is on TV or on our laptops, we cannot help but think, however, there is an issue of degree and things are changing. I think that symbolism is really useful for looking ahead, for acknowledging progress, for seeing that a people can overcome, and I think that we have to realize our own agency in all of this. That's a really valuable lesson, even if... Go ahead.
No, let me say this, and I think we will conclude, unless you want to, you know, to add something.
I'm done.
No, what I want to say is I don't think it's that important at the end of the day, John. I mean, I see what you're saying about it being in a way that a speech or a statistical report could never be.
Sure.
A statement unavoidable and clear about the wheel having turned in American race relations. Mm-hmm. I see that because the wheel has turned. No, we're not a post-racial society, but we're damn sure not a Jim Crow society either. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people don't know that, black and white. And Obama is definitely sending that. But here's the thing. I don't think at the end of the day, when we're talking about the presidency of the United States, that the narrative about African-American aspiration and the extent to which the dream remains unfulfilled is all that important. I don't think it adds up to that much. It was yesterday's story. It's a 1960s and it's a 1970s story. America is a dynamic society. There are more Latinos than there are African Americans. Asia is the site where the 21st century is going to unfold to a substantial degree. And this guy's president of the United States. He's commander-in-chief of the most powerful military in the history of the world. Now, the stakes are really not about whether or not black people know that there's been progress. I mean, that's a second or third order question. And I'm assessing whether or not his blackness has anything at all to do with how it is that this enormously powerful office gets conducted and how it is that this nation carries forward its business. Is our social policy going to look any different because we had a black president? The words poverty didn't even get mentioned in the campaign. Is our foreign policy going to look any different? I mean, from a certain point of African-American experiential point of view, the Palestinians are among the niggers of the world. They've gotten a terribly, terribly raw deal. Can that get any space within the American political conversation in virtue of an African-American having been elected president and so on? We still incarcerated an unbelievable and mind-boggling rate in the country, and you see where I'm going with this. Mm-hmm. Okay, so his blackness is incidental to that, in my opinion, and I just can't get to exercise one way or the other about it. And if he had lost, he wouldn't have lost because he was black. Some people would have said so. I would not have felt ashamed being an African-American that he lost. I mean, you know, anyway.
I want to add a little something.
Yes, sir.
You're right that the story is ending. The idea that America's main social problem is the one that the people talked about on the television show All in the Family is over. There's a story that's ending. And I think there are a lot of people, including white ones, who feel like it's their responsibility as good people to pretend that that story is not ending and that we're not passing the torch to other oppressed groups and to, you know, even outside of the United States. The story is ending. And what a better way for it to end, and what better thing for there to be that lets at least a certain more pliable segment of people understand that the ending is a just one in some ways than the fact that the black story ended with a black man as president. To me, I guess life is not a narrative, but that symbol there might help some people to understand that, yeah, phases end, the civil rights movement changes, and the prime antagonists have changed. And it's not that we're ignoring something. Something has really changed. That moves me somehow, although I know that I'm dwelling in symbolism to a large extent. It's odd, isn't it?
All right, John, I'm comforted to know that you're moved. Let's keep the conversation going, my friend. This has been has been fun.
I'm going to run up and do my school stuff, and I guess so are you. But let's do this again very soon.
Happy holidays, and we'll catch up sometime in December.
Same to you, Glenn.
Bye.
Bye.